Hello.
Hey, Jay, it's Dave Weiner. How you doing?
Hi, Dave.
Hey, we're recording, as we did last week.
All right.
A podcast which I think you've come up with a name for. Would you like to share that with everybody?
My suggested name was the Sunday Laundry Podcast Series.
And does that mean we're going to, like, take out all the dirty clothes? And,
actually, they're all back from the laundry, and they're waiting to be folded, but I'd rather talk to you.
Oh, that's really nice of you to say that. And maybe we can take out some, like, Republican and Democratic dirty laundry, too. but now we have a topic for today's podcast. And I sent you an email, and the topic is this. Is Twitter the savior of journalism?
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's kind of maybe a radical hypothesis. But, you know, we do understand that the mainstream media is in trouble. And at the same time that this has become a major topic, so has the topic of the Twitter sort of rising through all expectations has become itself has become mainstream, and to some of us maybe even disappointingly mainstream, and that you know, I had higher hopes, I think, than it would just be a vehicle for, you know, basketball stars and rap stars and stuff like that. I thought maybe we were doing something else. And then there are the questions of, well, is a tech company ready to actually run, if Twitter has some impact for journalism, is a tech company ready to be the host for that?
Mm.
So right. These are all things I'm interested in knowing what you think about this.
Mm-hmm.
So,
first of all, I really think we shouldn't talk in terms of saviors. And the reason I say that is the whole debunking discourse in the press has become really dysfunctional. And
what do you mean by debunking?
Well, what I mean is this week at CJR, I see a Columbia Journalism Review, I see a reporter sort of casually say, Huffington Post is supposed to be the future of journalism. And, of course, she's disagreeing with that. And when you say savior, it's not language that I really want to have anything to do with, because I can just see how, without understanding Twitter at all, we're going to get a rash of reports of people saying, I don't think Twitter is the savior of journalism. So I don't think there is any savior. I don't think there is a site or a tool or a method we can point to as the future.
So
I don't think there is a solution. And since we're going to have a pluralistic universe where lots of things work a little bit, we shouldn't really talk in terms of saviors or solutions.
I picked the wrong word then. Okay. Let's. What word would you like to use? I mean, will it play a role in journalism in the future?
Well, I think one role that Twitter already plays is that it's a better breaking news system than the old system for certain kinds of news. And when an earthquake happens in California, when there is a attack in Mumbai, when there is something that is sort of classic breaking news, the chances of finding out first through Twitter are much better than waiting around for CNN to find about it.
Right.
So it's obviously part of the news system already, because anybody who is interested in being first and isn't on Twitter isn't really
with
it.
But I can read about that on CNN or the New York Times. I'm trying to get a little bit deeper into it.
Okay.
And why would I talk to you is because you're not just sort of observing or Twitter, not even just dabbling with Twitter, but you're actually, I feel, pushing the envelope on Twitter. You're sort of trying to figure out what it's good at, what it isn't good at.
Yes,
so
that's my goal.
It's like, so I'm not, you know, I mean, I'm looking for something that we can't get elsewhere. It's like, think about it, Jay, think about it this way, okay? Try to be expansive or predicting, you know, predict predict where, I mean, if Twitter isn't enough to be a platform for journalism, then what is needed to make it a platform for journalism? And maybe it doesn't have to be Twitter as it is currently configured. Maybe Twitter with changes. In other words, wonder a little bit for me, okay?
Well, here's what I do think. When I talk about the web today to people, I try to get them to picture the mass audience before the age of the web. And the way that people were arranged spatially before the web was that they were all distributed around their homes and locations and connected up to big media, but fragmented and atomized from one another. So they were connected up to CNN, up to the White House, to the national economy, to the news, but they weren't, of course, connected across to one another. And the web makes it possible for us to be connected both ways. And I think of Twitter as an application that actually started to bring into the world the horizontal dimension that mass communication had always canceled out.
Right, but now...
And so that's why it's a potential news system, because it includes everyone who had been in the audience is now connected, if they're on Twitter, to the news system and to one another. And so it's that's the potential, is that everybody who's on Twitter is kind of connected to everybody else, and therefore we have some potential. Now, I think it starts to be a news system when you think of Twitter as integrated with the blogging system. So I think of Twitter plus blog as a sort of a complete set of tools that a contributor to the news system, whoever they may be, needs. And I think in that sense, it could be a platform for journalism.
Okay. I'm going to be a little bit of a curmudgeon here now. And,
all right.
Okay. But I'm not acting. This is serious. But you know, in theory, that sounds fantastic. But in practice, give you an example. A few days ago, I posted something on Twitter saying, "Boy, you know, I'm not too happy about how things are going at B of A. I'm beginning to worry. Bank of America. I'm beginning to worry about, you know, my deposits there." And somebody comes back and says, "Well, you don't have to worry if you have less than $250,000 there."
Mm-hmm.
But the story that I had pointed to in that initial tweet was a story that said that the FDIC might be running out of money and is going to have to go get $500 billion from Congress. This isn't the first time that story had been out there either. So the observation is that, sure, the information's all out there to be gotten, but is the average person on Twitter actually getting any of that information?
Well, there's a big difference between the information that is quote-unquote out there and the information that the public kind of owns and discusses. And one of the things that's cool about Twitter is that we can have an impact on that. And distributing knowledge more widely, putting people on the same page, informing them by pointing them to the facts that they need, is of course one of the great things about that system. But what journalists have tended to look at is what they put in to the system. Like for example, when we ask them, well, did the financial press really warn us about the dangers that we now see exploding all around us? Their answers are, we put those stories into the system. Today on Meet the Press, the reporter from CNBC, when asked how much responsibility he had, said, "Hey, look, I gave these warnings. If nobody listened, it's not my problem." Right? So part of
he was a little bit more smarmy about it than that, actually, I thought. You know.
Well, his thing was, I won an Emmy, or I was nominated for an Emmy, and I did all this work, but nobody, you know, and if nobody listened, that's not my problem.
Well, come on, Twitter
begins to give us a way to address that.
Do you want to know what I was thinking when I heard that? It was, you sent me the pointer to that I think it was a Columbia Journalism Review report that talked about the General Accounting Office report in the early 90s that actually
yes.
did describe the whole situation. Why don't you mm-hmm. tell the folks what that was all about?
That was an item in CJR, which is doing amazing work on the responsibility of the financial press in the current meltdown. Really, really strong stuff all around. And they pointed to a GAO report, Government Accounting Office report, way back in the mid-90s that raised alarms. I think it was about derivatives. I can't remember the exact details of it. And it just showed how when this devastating report by the Government Accounting Office, which is as close as we have to a nonpartisan auditor of the government, was released, it was sort of treated as a political football. The authority of the report was kind of discounted. The fact that there were people on a different side attacking it led to he said, she said coverage. And some of the problems that really exploded in the last few years were anticipated by that report. But the way that journalists deal with those reports is they just become part of the controversy and they kind of drift away and they have no effect. And then when we go back and we try to say, well, who's accountable here, what the reporters tell us is, hey, well, it's not our fault. We did the story. We covered that report. And what CJR was trying to say is, yeah, you covered it, but you didn't really give it the significance it deserved. And that was the same question today on Meet the Press.
Right. But nobody likes a spoiled sport. And so when there's a bubble party going on, the person who says, wait a minute, you know, there's a bubble, usually everybody says, well, why don't you just, like, take it somewhere else? We're not really interested.
Yeah, and that's currently the number one defense of the financial press.
Now, what if the loudest voices, the most listened to voices on Twitter, are voices that are somehow indebted to the company that's running the platform? Now, this question came up, and it was a piece that I wrote. And that was, you know, you have your pieces that get pointed to a lot. This one, off the charts in terms of how much coverage this one got, because it's, mm-hmm. it tapped into something that I think a lot of people are worried about. Mm-hmm. That is the company that's behind Twitter a mature enough company to actually be able to handle an environment that is used for real journalism? That mm-hmm. was sort of the core of what I was trying to get at in the lead-in, was that, you know, what would that company have to look like in order to not just be acceptable or adequate for journalism? How about excellent for journalism? You know, learning everything that we've learned about the publishing industry and how it had a negative impact on the quality of the journalism that was produced, you know, in the era that we're leaving now, okay? We're coming into something new, right?
Mm-hmm.
How will this work? And if so, how could it be better than what we had before?
Well, I read your post. I read it very carefully. And I took your point about the difference between Twitter the service and Twitter the company. And Twitter the company may not be best for Twitter the service. I think that's a very intelligent point. And they may not realize quite what they have, but that wouldn't be unusual for a growing technology company. I myself wasn't that focused on the suggested users thing. I didn't really know about it until you wrote about it. I was dimly aware of it because I saw that Anna Marie Cox jumped, but I think I saw it from one of your messages, from like 20,000 or something to like 80,000. But since I'm not interested in making a commercial killing from my Twitter feed, I don't have any commercial ambitions, it doesn't really bother me that much.
Why? I don't get it. Because don't you agree that there's a dollar value to the followers that they're giving?
I think there probably is for somebody like Jason
Calacanis.
Well, then
you have journalists that are receiving dollars from the platform vendor. Now, are those journalists likely to do any investigation into them? Are they going to have a warm place in their heart? Does it affect their integrity? The fact that they've received this gift that, according to one person, is worth $250,000.
Well, I mean, I think if you were dealing with an individual journalist who was a tech reporter who had to cover Twitter but had been on the suggested users list, I can see a problem there, yeah.
Why would you limit it only to tech reporters? Because this is becoming a mainstream news platform.
Well, what I say, what I mean, Dave, is that the New York Times is bigger than Twitter, and it doesn't really care if Twitter recommends it or not.
You sure that that's true for all time?
Well, right now it's true. Okay. I don't know. I can't say if it's true
do
for all
time.
Do you
see how quickly Twitter is growing, Jay?
I think it is getting very big.
How far
in
the future do you have to look before that is a serious issue for even the New York Times?
Well, if I was advising them, I would have told them not to do that suggested users thing. But my point is, I'm not personally that upset.
No, that's not what I'm getting at. What would you advise the New York Times? In other words, they just received a gift of $250,000. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that it's worth $250,000, what they just received. Could the New York Times receive a gift of $250,000 from Ford Motor Company?
No, that would definitely be against their principles if they...
Well, then why is it okay for them to receive it from a technology company?
Basically because they don't understand what they got.
Right, but in your view of it as a journalism professor, is that an excuse?
Is it an excuse for the New York Times to not be aware of this? No, I wouldn't say that. They should be aware of it, but it's not something that I would get terrifically excited about, but I grant your point.
Okay. I just drop it. I mean, maybe there's not a whole lot to talk about here, because I felt that...
Well, tell me how you think it through.
Well, I think that it's inevitable that a publication that received a gift like that would be so conflicted by that gift that it would ruin the whole experience of using... In fact, I find that it ruins my whole experience of using Twitter as a platform for delivering news. Because almost everything I do is now colored by that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, let's say I put up something that's not critical of Twitter. Will people think that I'm doing that because I would like them to include me in the suggested users list? You know, when I put up something that is critical of them, okay, I don't see that I have a problem with that. But let's say one of the companies that's like, for example, I got attacked by TechCrunch personally integrity issues. And I don't want to dive into that, by the way, Jay. That's not the purpose of this, okay?
I'm not commenting on that.
I don't want to. That was really serious. I wasn't, like, that wasn't a joke. Serious about that. But the question then is that since TechCrunch is one of the companies that received this gift, maybe they're attacking me because this is a service they're providing for Twitter, you know?
Mm.
And, you know, maybe there's a quid pro quo on that. I don't think there is, okay? But the question is out there. Because of this relationship that they have with Twitter. I mean, I got to say that if I had received that, okay, I might, and I don't know what I would have done, but I might have said, look, I can't receive that. You need to take me off that list.
Yeah, I see where you're going with that. I thought it was fascinating that Jason Calacanis offered to pay, what was it, $250,000 to be on that list or something?
Yeah.
Very interesting. But I see where you're going with this, and I'm not sure that I would want to be on that list. And the reason is not what you said so much. It's that the value to me of the people who follow my Twitter feed is tied up with the fact that they selected my Twitter feed. And I don't necessarily think it would be so valuable for me or useful for me to have all these people who are kind of following what I'm saying for no particular reason or because someone told them to, or they don't exactly know why. I think it's more valuable for me, for what I do, to talk to people who have said, this is important for me, this is something I want, this is something I want to continue to receive. And I think those people are more valuable. But for myself as a user, I try to like not pay attention to this stuff. I'm trying to pay like less attention to how many people are following me and more attention to just what I'm doing. Like I used to note that I passed 5,000, I passed 6,000. Now I don't even care. Mm-hmm. It just sort of happens by itself. And I'm more focused on what I'm putting out as well as who should be and what should be in the 500 or so people I follow, because it's really the inflow that's providing me with the service that feeds into my outflow. And I think this is where the significance of Twitter is for me in journalism. It's not broadcasting your message out. I mean, you can always use Twitter to do that, but it's really what you're able to get in.
Interesting. Good. That's the kind of stuff I was hoping to get to. I just noticed that exact phenomenon happening with Anna Marie Cox, who I've been following since she started using Twitter. Pretty close to when she started. And I love the way she uses Twitter, much the way I love the way that you use Twitter. And you could see that it was changing her, that she was getting some reaction. She called herself at one point the newest pet rock, you know, and she's sort of mocking her, not just herself, but the people, all these, you know, random people that don't know who she is that are now following her just because, you know, that she happened to get recommended. I also wanted to say that on FriendFeed, okay, that the way you describe it, that is exactly, I don't even know how many people follow me on FriendFeed, but there's a difference because FriendFeed doesn't put that up front on my profile page. It's not a big number. It's not very prominent, okay? Whereas in Twitter, it's a whole other universe, okay? As soon as you click on my name, that's the first piece of information you see about me, other than whatever label I happen to put on myself. Now, I also am very close in philosophy to where you are. I've never done anything specifically to get anyone to follow me, okay? And that's very important for me. It's that I sort of do what I do, and I let the followers come as they come. Now, it doesn't mean I don't try to be entertaining and interesting and deserve the followers, but I don't ever do any of the gaming or, you know. Now, for Jason Calcanis, is a whole other story, okay? And I don't say that what he's doing is any less legitimate than what you and I do. He just views the medium differently than we do. Mm-hmm. And same with Guy Kawasaki and Robert Scoble, Leo Laporte, Loic Lemur, you know, Kevin. Now, then there's a whole other class of people like Kevin Rose, okay? And Kevin Rose has 250,000 followers, right? Now, Leo, right, is pretty amazing, isn't it? And so I guess sort of, now, you know, that it wasn't that long ago that Kevin Rose had 30,000 followers. It might have been a month.
So yeah, I noticed that. When your post came out, I looked at a few of them, and I noticed that.
So
and that is distorted.
You kind of have to extrapolate that this medium is changing at an incredible rate. I mean, just pause for a moment and just reflect on that. Let's say the number is 30,000. I don't know what the actual number is. 30 to 250 in 30 days.
Right.
What's going to happen in another month?
And we don't know.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So now the question is, do we have two Twitters, three Twitters, five Twitters?
Well, I
Twitters
do think, the element of celebrity has definitely entered Twitter over the last month or so, and I certainly noticed that, but I also feel like, you know, big news, celebrity has, you know, infiltrated every other aspect of American life, so you can't exactly say it's a surprise, but sure, that has happened. And
so
it does
change. Are we
getting
another TV here? Are we getting...
I don't know about that.
Prime time TV?
I don't know, because if you go back to my description of all those people on the receiving end of the mass media who were connected up but not across, who are now connected to one another, Twitter is the few-to-few world coming alive. It is the destruction of one-to-many communication. And the one-to-many stars can still come into it, and of course they're still major stars, but there's so much going on around them and underneath them and instead of them that they're just players in a very big pool. And so I don't think that they're necessarily poised to dominate, especially because very few of them are interested in being two-way anyway, you know? And if you have somebody who's a major celebrity, who's hundreds of thousands of followers, who also figures out how to be extremely two-way, well, that would be different.
Nobody believes that can happen.
Nobody believes that, of course, because it's very hard, and it would take a lot of time, and it'd take a lot of thought, and we haven't necessarily seen that.
No, there was an excellent editorial in the Chicago Tribune last week about that.
Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm not that worried about it, and it's fine with me if Shaq is there, and it's even better in a way that some of the big media stars are there, because as a critic, I can now address myself to them in a way that's really quite different, even though they're not necessarily going to answer me. And so I don't mind it that a David Gregory or George Stephanopoulos is on Twitter. I think it's good, and even though they're mostly broadcasting, maybe a little bit of two-way communication will rub off on them.
I did get a put down from Carl Rove, by the way.
You got a personal put down from Carl Rove?
I did.
Really? That's pretty cool. What did he say?
I'm getting this horrible echo in my ear right now. This is really bothering me. Can you hear my echo?
No.
Okay, how am I going to get rid of this? This is really bad. I don't know what I did. Let me just try to go on. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. What he said was I'm trying to remember the conversation. He had said that Obama had invented a straw man. That's right. He invented a straw man in his pseudo State of the Union speech, you know, and he said he just invented him. This person doesn't even exist. And it was pretty obvious that he was talking about Reagan. Okay, I don't think there was any question anybody listening to the speech that speech was a debate between Obama undoing what Reagan had done. So that's what I said, and Rove responded with nonsense. I mean, what he responded with didn't actually make any sense. Mm-hmm. And I commented. I said, "We've now completely recreated the news conversation on Twitter. You know, guy says something ridiculous, and then he spins me by just saying something. You know, it's this fight these guys have with each other that, you know, the reporter asks a question, and Carl Rove doesn't answer it. So he asks the question again. Keep doing this until the reporter finally gives up.
Right.
So I got to go around with Carl Rove. I can get you the conversation. It was discussed on Friend Feed, even though it took place on Twitter. But I think that that's the last time that's going to happen.
Yeah.
I think that very soon Carl Rove will be in the 250,000 follower range. And at that point, he won't be able to, and we won't see the need to. What probably happened here was Carl Rove went and looked at my thing and saw that I had three times as many followers as he does and thought maybe I ought to have a conversation with this guy or maybe I ought to respond to him.
Huh. Right.
And I feel like that, in a sense, is something where I have an edge, and as a result, the people who follow me have an edge that we're about to completely lose.
Yeah, well, that's probably true.
Right, it is.
Yeah.
So I mean, I guess the question, the echo has gone away now, so I feel much better. The question I'm sort of trying to get at is, and I'm very happy with the way this is going. It's like, okay, Twitter is morphing. Things are changing. In the meantime, the press is falling apart, or something's happened. Something's
not
happening.
A savior.
Something's happening. Yes, we've agreed it's not a savior, okay? And so things are changing very quickly. Now, can we get a lot of the news process? How many people read the New York Times outside of Twitter? What, do you have an idea of what that number is?
It would be in the range of 20 million online.
20 million. So how much more does Twitter have to grow before it's at least a significant part of the flow of the New York Times? They're at 250,000 now, too.
I don't know the answer to that question, but it's already a significant driver of traffic to news sites, I'm sure.
So suppose there comes a point when Twitter is more than just a significant contributor to flow. Let's suppose, just for the sake of argument, Twitter becomes the most significant flow. And now, how do you think news adjusts to that? And how does Twitter adjust to that? What will Twitter look like when that happens?
I'm not smart enough to answer that question. I really don't know, and I try to stay away from projecting too far into the future, because people immediately latch on to that as some kind of prediction that they can debunk, you know. I think we're moving to a system where there is not one new system. There are overlapping ones, and there is a kind of decentralizing of influence, and there will still be big providers of news like the New York Times, but they won't develop their authority in the same way. And I think a lot of different institutions will rise to do journalistic things, and that some of them will be companies and some of them won't. Some of them will be institutions and some of them will be individuals. But I could sort of see how Twitter is like the turnstile of the news system, you know? It's like the entry point for people, and it's how they connect to the rest of the news system. And that's already the case with breaking news. And increasingly, people are using Twitter the way I say I use it in that LA Times piece this week, which is to edit the web for them. And that's probably the significance of it, is that it's becoming the best way to edit the web and therefore to filter your own flow of news.
Interesting. So let's try another direction on this. And obviously, anytime you don't want to go into the future, please say so, okay? But think about YouTube versus Hulu, right? And when Hulu first mm-hmm. came out, it was pretty much universally dismissed as being, you know, too little, too late, completely lame, had no chance of success, whatever, you know, all of it like that, basically. And then, surprise, surprise, Hulu comes out, everybody likes it. A year later, it's a huge success, right? So can you imagine the same sort of thing happening in this space, where at some point the big media companies realize, wait a minute, this actually kind of works. Why don't we start our own Twitter? Can you see the New York Times ever doing that, or some other, you know, some TV network or something? Does that seem like a possibility to you?
I highly doubt it. The other day, Thursday, at Stony Brook, Arthur Sulzberger gave a keynote address, and he said that something I've been waiting for somebody like him to say for about 15 years, that journalism has been a one-way system with readers. We have communicated with readers in a one-way fashion. And, of course, he mentioned this because it's something that they have to change. And my own view is that most of the media companies that we know of, the major brands in mass media, are not just accustomed to one-way and one-to-many communication. That is their DNA. It's at the deepest roots of their thinking. They see communication as broadcasting. And so I don't see them as coming up with the next Twitter. But I do see them as able to adapt to such systems when other people think them up.
Well, I wasn't saying they would come up with the next Twitter. I was thinking that they would copy Twitter.
Oh, they could try to do that, but I don't think they see it as central enough to what they're doing to put any effort into that.
Okay.
They see what they're doing as creating good editorial content and distributing it on any platform that they can. And that is why originally they're open to Twitter, because it's another way to distribute their platform, their content. Arthur Sulzberger says, we're platform agnostic. That's his big idea, right? And so when something comes along and they can distribute what they have, they will do that.
But But wait a minute, now I'm going to be like George Stephanopoulos, and I'm going to catch you here. You know, I
kind
of got you here, Jay. but it's a friendly gotcha. It won't hurt. At the same time, they're not a platform. They came out with an API, right?
I saw that.
And then immediately thereafter comes the Guardian with their API, you know?
Right.
And the thing that's singularly interesting about both of them is that their API, while they are quote-unquote open, do not allow anybody to jump on their side of the API. So I can't publish through the New York Times, which is kind of what I've been waiting for them to say.
Could you explain what you mean by that? Publish through the New York Times? Because I read that in your in your post, but I didn't quite get it.
That's the big transition that they all have to make. It's not just in the news industry. It's in the tech industry, too. There's this big problem is that there's this line, right? There's this wall. And we're out here on this side of the wall, and they're on that side of the wall, okay? And now in the tech industry, the wall is more generous to the users than it is in the news industry. The wall says basically, we're allowed to create content. We're just not allowed to replace them. In other words, there's some part of the proposition where we're just not allowed to replace something about them, okay? Mm-hmm. In the tech industry, we're not allowed to run the servers, okay? We can't run the servers. And not only that, only a very small number of people get what's called the fire hose. The fire hose is the flow of all of the messages that go through Twitter. There's no technical reason they couldn't let anybody have it. They say that there is a technical reason. I think they're lying, basically.
The New York Times, this is what? We can't do what?
I can't write for the New York Times. I want to be able to write for the New York Times. I want to be able to put content on their side of the API. And, Jay, my argument is that until they do that, they will not solve their problem. Until there is a time when anybody can write for the New York Times, they will constantly be dealing with the adverse economics of the world that they now live in, which says basically, okay, if I can't write for the New York Times, then I'll write for my blog. You know? And I still manage to compete with them editorially doing that. I just don't do it with the authority. The trick is to somehow, for them, and I don't say that this isn't some kind of hard trick, because it is to, at the same time, while they let me write for them, to produce a product which has the quality, maybe even more. See, my argument is that if they did that, what would happen is the quality of their product would go through the roof. Because they would have to find a way to vet the content. But instead of a shortage of content, they would have a complete surplus of it. And they would have to learn how to deal with the surplus instead of what they're having to deal with is a shrinking editorial staff.
Well, based on the conversation I had with somebody at the New York Times this week, I'm sorry I can't tell you more about it because it wasn't an on-the-record conversation, but based on that, I would say that if they could distribute and communicate to potential contributors a common set of standards that really were observed, that they might be open to that thing. So you had that in the tech industry, right? You had the notion of standards, like we need standards or this thing cannot grow. And it's that, I think, that is in the way. It's if we could get to that point where people see certain standards of verifiability, standards of transparency, standards of factuality, that there's a possibility it could happen. So if you want it to happen, we have to work on this notion of standards, maybe borrowed from the tech industry, but transposed over to the editorial domain.
Well, the answer is yes. I would be happy to work with anybody who wants to work on that, and most especially an organization with the stature of the New York Times. I've been asking to do that forever. I mean, you know, and I said in the piece that I wrote is that it's so sad that these two organizations, both of which are excellent, The Guardian and The New York Times.
They're both great,
That it's so sad that they don't see their contribution to the open world as being where they're strong and where they have special advantages. Instead, they're trying to be of the tech industry, at which they're not very special.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing it with both hands tied behind their back that no tech industry player ever would tie themselves.
Right.
The scam of the tech industry is the opposite. We want the users to do all the work, and we don't want to do any of it. All we want to do is kick back and, you know, go public and make a jillion dollars, and, you know, the poor users sit there, you know,
right,
wondering, well, how come I didn't get any of that? You know, it's like,
well,
I think pretty screwed up too, you know.
A little insight for you. Part of the reason that you run into maybe more resistance than you would think is it has to do with the experience that people in editorial environments, especially a high-powered one like the New York Times, have, is they confront constantly, every day you walk out of the office with your notebook, a constant barrage of people and institutions who are trying to spin you and influence the news and become kind of an interested actor within the news. And much of their experience day-to-day is fending off those people, often very powerful people, who want to spin, slant, and otherwise shape the portrait that comes out. And when you day-to-day fight against that, you develop a kind of mental image of people all trying to spin you. And I think there's a very powerful effect that this has on people in editorial environments who think that they're the protection against PR, against a culture entirely flooded by PR. And they think of people who aren't trained professionals as having an axe to grind, as all having a perspective, as all having their bias, as Dave Weiner tells us the world according to Dave Weiner. And it's really that's in the way, not any of the technical problems. And they've even come around to the idea that, and I know they have at the New York Times, that the people out there have a lot to contribute, but it's these sticking points that have to do a lot with the nature of their experience that have shaped the attitudes you're running into.
It's so interesting, and this is a potential topic for a whole other podcast, because as you're telling this story, you're telling my story as relates to my experience dealing with reporters, that they're always trying to drive me into a particular corner, which I know is ridiculous. I know that there's nothing there. You know what I mean? They're just pushing me into this corner every way they can possibly get me over there. And I know that if they report that there was something there, that they're lying, you know, because I know there's nothing there. And at the same time, these reporters always have to get a story, and it has to fit some certain template, even if the actual event did not have that form, you know. They need the salacious detail. They need somebody who's being dishonest. They need to be Woodward or Bernstein. You know, I hate it when people say the truth always lies somewhere in between. But I think we've gotten so divorced from reality in this whole news area that the best thing we can all do is say, okay, let's set some goals. Let's try to figure out what we're trying to do here. We're about to go to zero. Now we get to do it over again. How do we want to do it? You know.
Well, we need something like that. But I think most people who regularly deal with reporters have complaints like that.
I don't doubt it. I once asked a room full of about 200 CTOs and CEOs of tech companies, anybody raise your hand if you ever feel you've been fairly quoted? And that wasn't like if you ever feel you've been unfairly quoted. I was asking if anybody wanted to stand up and say that there had ever been a news story they'd been interviewed for where they felt that the result was fair. Not one hand went up, Jay.
Well,
I understand. I understand. It's dramatic, right?
Yeah, that's a little bit overboard, but I know what they're saying. when they say that.
And maybe some of them are thinking, I wasn't able to spin the reporter, right?
Yeah.
But also, some of them are honest people who really would like to just tell the truth. Some of them are. Maybe not many, but some.
Well, on this topic, I was fascinated today in the Ombudsman column in the New York Times, which was about whether the Times should be more up and sort of positive in its economic news. And, of course, the Ombudsman was saying no. He quoted an economics reporter who said that my master is reality. And the example that he gave was interviewing two well-known economists who both said that there was a chance we could lapse into depression. And therefore, how could he ignore what those economists said? And he had to put the possibility of lapsing into a depression into his account, because that was what it meant to obey reality, right? And I think that's just a fascinating way of constructing his situation.
What's wrong with that? That sounds right to me.
Well, it's not that it's wrong, and I know what he's saying is that his job is not to try and lift the economy. His job is not to make sure that people are positive, right? His job is not a public relations job, and it's not to guarantee a certain outcome. I understand all that. What he's really doing is consulting authorized knowers from a kind of list, and it's those authorized knowers that present him with a sense of reality.
Of course.
And they are not the only authorized knowers he could go to. And if we looked at, well, what are the rules for choosing who is an authorized knower and who isn't, pretty soon we're pretty far from reality, if you know what I mean.
Okay, put a note right there. We got to come back at some point and do a whole half hour on that. Okay?
All right.
This idea of how random is the news, and maybe in the future it may not be quite so random. How could we make it?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's random. I would say it's constructed.
Well, I'm saying the same thing. It's basically, obviously. Yeah, it's a whole other question. Is there any objective news? I mean, can you say that this actually happened when it could all be subjected to who did you talk to get the story, right? You know, and who knows? But see, the point is, and this goes back to the media that we now have to work with, it gives the user a lot more power to select who they're going to listen to.
Yeah.
So that has some really serious, potentially very positive impact on how information flows. Never mind whether you call it news or not. It's just, you know, how does it all flow?
And the users have more power, and therefore the politics of news is different at the deepest level.
I think that's a great place to end, because we're now at 50 minutes. So, Jay, thanks so much, and I hope we can do this again soon.
Always a pleasure, Dave.